a path for the peace paradigm. King and Gandhi, many more, have discovered something core. Now we're building a path for the peace paradigm. Every challenge is another highway sign on the path of the peace paradigm. Ooh, 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 ooh,
ooh. You're listening to Peace Paradigm Radio, the show where we explore the power of active nonviolence. I'm your host, Stephanie Van Hook, and I'm here in the studio at KWMR in Point Reyes Station, our mother station, with my co-host, Michael Nigler. And today is Friday, August 21st, 2015. We have a question for you. Do you think that nonviolence only works? Say that you admit at least that you think that nonviolence kind of works, maybe in communication or in personal interactions. But do you think that it could possibly work on an institutional level, at a bigger level? Do you think that nonviolence could ever replace the war system? Are there constructive ways of going about resolving our conflicts socially that go beyond just individual interactions? And so today we're going to ask some of these questions and really think about them as we talk with Tiffany Eastholm of the Nonviolent Peace Force. Now, we've had people from the Nonviolent Peace Force on our show today. This is an unarmed civilian peacekeeping group. It's one of the new institutions in nonviolence. And it's really made a lot of headway and changed a lot over the past years. And so we really want to get into this topic of what is this and how is it working? And the interesting thing about our guest today is that she's been working in South Sudan most recently, and she has another project that she'll tell us about, I hope so, a little bit, that is even escalating some of the challenges, I think, or maybe even learning from the challenges that she had in the South Sudan project into this other project, which we'll tell you about. And so it's going to be really interesting. Tiffany Eastholm is our guest, and welcome to Peace Paradigm Radio. Tiffany. Okay, so we're going to get Tiffany back on the phone, but until then, how about Michael, you bring us into some news while I get Tiffany in.
Good. Good. I'm happy to try to do that, Stephanie. One of the reasons that we're so excited about unarmed civilian peacekeeping is that one of the main objections that we always hear to the possibility of nonviolence is that, oh, yes, it worked in India because the British were so polite, but it would never have worked against the Nazis. It wouldn't work today against ISIS. And basically, these objections all stem from the perception of nonviolence as a very weak force. And so the fact is that these unarmed civilian peacekeeping groups have been going into the most dangerous conflicts in the world. And I can hardly think of one that's more extreme than South Sudan. So, Tiffany Eastholm, we are so honored and pleased to welcome you to Peace Paradigm Radio.
Thank you, Mike.
Go ahead. So, yeah, well, great to have you, Tiffany. And, Michael, why don't you get us started with some questions?
Yes. Tiffany, can you give us a little bit first of your personal background, where you're from, other than Canada, and how did you get interested in this amazing work that you're doing?
Sure. Well, thank you so much for having me on today. As you said, I'm from Canada, specifically Victoria on Vancouver Island. So I share the coast with you all. And I got quite interested in this work when I was studying, doing my master's program. I did a master's program in human security and peace building at Royal Roads University in Victoria. And through the course of that study, became extremely interested in, first and foremost, the real obvious reality of the what happens to civilians in the course of conflict. And throughout history, and it's the same conflict over conflict, that the civilians take the brunt of the suffering that happens during a violent conflict and have the least amount of power during that process when political forces, economic forces, bigger than the individual are at play. And then it's in second to that, what I became particularly interested in is what looking at those examples where civilians have been able to protect themselves, where they work together in small groups or large groups to create space and safety around themselves to try and facilitate as much normalcy as possible during violent conflict. And how does that work? What are the conditions at play? How do they resist being pulled into violent conflict when it's all around them and pressures are pushing them into it? And so it was from there that I became very much interested in, in studying that and learning about it, and then in some way being able to contribute. So I initially started out in working for Peace Brigades International. 9 years ago, almost 10 years ago now. And then after finishing up there, I started working for Nonviolent Peace Force in Sri Lanka, and then have been now in South Sudan for the last 5 years, working on unarmed civilian protection and peacekeeping work and community-led violence reduction work.
Good. And today you are making a transition from loyal listener of Peace Paradigm Radio to a content provider. We're extremely pleased. Tiffany, you mentioned PBI, and of course they were a leader in this field. They were pioneering. Mm-hmm. And one of the debates that I was privy to in that organization was, from time to time, shall we focus primarily or exclusively on protective accompaniment, or shall we look into a broader spectrum of ways of intervening in conflict? How has that played out in PBI, and how do you see that issue today in the whole field of what is now called unarmed civilian peacekeeping?
Sure. I mean, that was certainly a hot topic when I was involved. I was in the Indonesia project, and we were piloting at that point a peace education, or what we were calling at that time peace education program that ran in conjunction with our protective accompaniment work. And we were, quite seen as a little bit of outliers in the PBI world because of that, and it was certainly a hot topic. I mean, I guess I often describe sort of the PBI world as doing what they do exceptionally well, a very narrow mandate, and they go very deep in that process. And they are certainly the leaders in providing protective accompaniment, very especially for civil society activists, human rights defenders, and they do it exceptionally well. I know for myself.
Excuse me, Tiffany, you know what? I realized we should actually tell some of our listeners what protective accompaniment is.
That says, yes, an important distinction. Well, protective accompaniment is when we work with either an individual or a small group of people or a community who are under threat for specific reasons. It might be because of the work that they're doing. It might be because of their ethnic identity. It might be because of their gender identity. But for whatever reason, some force within a power structure is threatened by them, by their existence, and by what they're doing. And what we do is we work with them to try and be able to help those people live as normal of life as possible, to mitigate the threats, and eventually to dissipate those threats. And so the physical manifestation of protective accompaniment is what you would see is exactly what the word sounds like. We work in groups of two or maybe more if it's a larger group, and we will accompany, as I said, individuals or small groups, their office, to their school, at their home, whatever they need to be. And as the physical manifestation of the international community, we present a visual representation of the international community's concern, parent concern for those people. Now, it's not only our physical presence, it's also the fact that we are working in communities where we are known. They know why we're there, and we also really work to leverage those relationships and to let them know but our concern is for the safety and security of this person or these people, and that's why we're with them. And what we find is that would-be threats or threats would-be aggressors very rarely will act on those threats if the person is accompanied.
So
basically the premise of it.
So protective accompaniment. So are you using weapons for this? How do you deter people from?
Sure. Yeah. It's really based on our relationship. Mm-hmm. It's based on bearing witness. I often use the analogy of domestic violence to help people start to understand is that if you are at your neighbor's house, and there is an inherent relationship that is of domestic violence in the neighbor's home, it's very unlikely will you see that manifested while you are there. And so it's a good way to sort of try and illustrate what it looks like or what the thinking is. We try and help duty bearers, those who have the responsibility to protect civilians, recognize the political benefit for taking up that role. And we try and help people who would be aggressing on civilians recognize the political cost of what it means to be seen as a perpetrator of violence against the international about unarmed civilians. And we build our relationship. So we're nonpartisan. We don't choose sides in a conflict. We are seen and known and eventually become trusted. It takes a lot of work to get to that place. As people who are concerned, our only concern is the safety and security of civilians. And so by leveraging that relationship and then being present and bearing witness, then we're able to deter would-be attackers from actualizing on the threat.
Tiffany, we're talking with Tiffany Eastholm from Nonviolent Peace Force, and I'm going to ask you in a minute to tell us about the work that you're doing now or very recently in South Sudan. Mm-hmm. But I had a comment I want to run past you mm-hmm. as such an experienced person in this field. I've always felt that there's a deeper kind of dynamic in this protection process that's going on, namely that even within a would-be attacker, there is another person, if you will, who does mm-hmm. not want to aggress mm. and does not have the permission to not aggress, and that a third party being there kind of holds up a mirror to that, shall we say, better angel in the would-be attacker and reminds them that the situation is not just polarization of me against you, but there's a larger human issue involved. Could you comment on that?
I mean, absolutely. It's the core of nonviolence. It's connecting what some people call the divinity and some people call the humanity within one another. And that's an excellent description of the very intense of relationship building that we do with people. And it is so interesting to engage with people who are part and parcel with inherently a violent structure in the work that we're doing. And what we find, and it is truly one of the most moving experiences you can imagine, is that when we can connect as humans in that way, we will also often hear from those folks and say they will find a way to make it safer. They will find a way. They will express their own concern. I've been in the presence of sort of young men in their early 20s, heavily armed, 2 to 3 AK-47s on their shoulders, who literally have dissolved into tears, saying, I don't know what I'm fighting for. I don't want to be doing this. And once we can do that and make that connection and they are treated as humans, that they are not just part of a violent system, then we make pretty significant headway in terms of creating safer space for everyone involved.
That is just wonderful. Tiffany, I think the key word that I'm taking out of what you were saying, and incidentally, this is not the best connection in the world. Mm. Sounds a little bit like you're still in Juba. But the thing that really leapt out at me in what you said was that treating people as individuals, mm. getting them out of this kind of ideological, stereotyped category, and making them individual human beings. And that is the secret for de-escalating violence and reestablishing harmony. So let me ask you a pointed question and then get on to what exactly you people have been doing in South Sudan. It's my understanding that to this time, no one who was under direct accompaniment has been abducted or killed. There have been some who were being protected during a period of time, but not at that moment. We're taking away that happened in San Jose de Apartado in Colombia. But I want to emphasize this, not because I think we should say, hey, this is a safe thing to do, but because we want to emphasize that across the board, nonviolence is a safer way to go than violence. What would you say?
Yeah, I think as far as I know, you are absolutely correct. And we're always very careful when we talk about this. We don't want to appear that we, as if we're not taking security seriously, or as if we assume simply through our presence there is this is a guarantee of safety or security. Every situation is different. Every situation is very carefully analyzed and planned for. But we absolutely have an extraordinary success rate during the process of accompaniment and the process of protective presence for exactly what you are saying. And we actually see an escalation in violence when you bring an additional armed actor onto the scene, is that the use of nonviolence tends to be the safest way to go.
That's Tiffany, that's really interesting, because a lot of people, when they think of nonviolence, they think of running away, they think of doing nothing. And you said very careful, very practiced nonviolence, which is neither running away nor aggressing, using violent force or even the threat power that comes with violence. Can you talk about that in the context of your work in South Sudan? Because it must be a very hard situation, I think, to talk about, because when we look at how the news is reporting what we're hearing from South Sudan, it sounds pretty bad. It sounds pretty violent, and it doesn't look like there is a nonviolent solution coming out of that. So how is nonviolence working within the midst of a very violent conflict?
Sure. I mean, nonviolence is a very active process. And we have, so in South Sudan, I mean, we have 10 field teams across the country who are living and working in heavily affected communities, or communities that are heavily affected by the violent conflict. What we see, it's a number of things. So certainly what you see in the media are the extraordinary dynamic moments of violence. It's an unfortunate reality of most of our media that we see. But the reality of living in a conflict area is that violence ebbs and flows, even in the most heavily affected areas. So you've got your sort of, you know, looking at the broader range of large-scale violence when there is a military incursion, there's firefights between fighting forces. These are sort of the bigger things that happen around.
Tiffany, I'm afraid you're breaking up there. When we get back to you, I wanted to point out that what you just said about how the introduction of an armed actor actually escalates the violence and not the reverse, it reminded me of something that Derek Oakley said after his remarkable experience that I want to hear you describe. He said, if I'd had a weapon that day, I would have been killed.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sorry, we were kind of breaking up. Do you want to finish up what you were saying and then comment on that story?
And then come back to that?
Yeah.
I mean, maybe just to summarize, sort of within the scope of the violent conflict in South Sudan, what we have seen is that the vast majority of civilians that we work with want to live in a peaceful way. They want peace in the sense of the word, a political peace deal. They would like to see their country return to normalcy. But more importantly, and what means more to them on a day-to-day basis, is that they want to be able to live in peace with their neighbors, with those around them, even if the broader political fight is continuing and they can't control that. And so our teams working together with the communities on the ground to help strengthen their capacity to engage in building peace, self-protection, working in negotiating space for themselves with both the state and non-state armed actors, we are able to help them create a little bit more space so that they can live in a more stable and predictable environment. And this is happening both inside displacement camps as well as in deep rural communities that are being affected by the violence in and of itself.
Yeah, you know, this is something that is, as well, I mean, taking it to a much smaller level, and I work as a preschool teacher, and when in this small society, when there's something that's aggressive taking place, most of the children are not engaging in that. And so if as the teachers in the classroom, if we put all of our attention on the child who is misbehaving in the situation and give that child all of our attention, the other ones feel less secure, and it reinforces the negative behavior, and we're all engaged in that all of a sudden, versus, you know, teaming up with my teacher, and we, you know, will neutralize the aggression that's happening in a very nonviolent way, but then also reinforcing the peace behavior that's around us as well helps to strengthen it.
I think that's such a great point, Stephanie. One of the things that I find very comforting working in conflict is you see that conflict dynamics, whether they be interpersonal or interstate, have very similar patterns. And it makes it, people are often sort of paralyzed by the complexity of interstate or intrastate conflict. But when you spend a great deal of time working within, living within, and studying, you will recognize the patterns that you are describing in your preschool. And it makes it so much easier. It gives me hope that, and it gives me strength to be able to engage, because it's not beyond any of our control. We think, we sit back, we watch the news, and we think there's nothing we can do about that. That's too complicated. There's people in power dealing with that, and we don't understand it. But we do, because we do it every day in our lives. And those dynamics are absolutely the same. And there are entry points as it's as porous as you could possibly imagine. When you look at a complex conflict situation, there are entry points infinitum for engaging on protection and peace building and nonviolence.
I'm so glad to hear you say that, because I used to have this argument with my colleagues when I was trying to build up the idea of what we now call unarmed civilian peacekeeping. And in the academic and policy worlds, like 20 years ago, they would always tell me that you cannot extrapolate from the dynamics of individual conflict to state conflicts. It's much too complicated. And I think that's an artifact of having a PhD.
Yes, from my on-the-ground experience, I think you very much can.
Speaking of on-the-ground experience, I've learned so much in the years that I've been watching and trying to assist in the development of this institution, and so many mistakes I made in the early days in my naivete. I had never realized the importance of working with communities on the ground. I thought of peacekeeping and protective accompaniment as, you know, kind of Captain Marvel, parachuting into a situation, fixing it and going away. But that is so not what happens. So could you tell us then about this remarkable episode that took place with Derek and Andres? Yeah.
Sure. Yeah, this happened last April. Derek and Andreas were part of our team in a place called Bor, which is the capital of Jonglei State in southern Sudan, South Sudan, working in the protection of civilian sites. So when the war broke out, thousands and thousands of people in communities ran into the UN bases for physical protection when the fighting came, as there's very little physical infrastructure to protect people in the towns and villages of South Sudan. So this happened inside there. We have had a team that was, and still do, have a team working inside there with the conflict-affected community. And a group of armed actors breached the perimeter. So there was, the group inside was of one ethnicity. The group that came in was of another. And it was sort of a mini manifestation of the civil war that was going on. And so they came in. Derek and Andreas had been inside the POC site. They were planning an activity for that day. They were actually, interestingly, the activity, major activity of the day, was to provide protective accompaniment for women to leave the POC site to go collect firewood. And then they'd heard, they were getting information that there was some, what was being called protesters at that time, coming in the area. So they went to speak to the women, and together deciding that it was not a good time until they had more information, and to temporarily to reschedule the trip outside of the perimeter. Long story short, this group of what was being called protesters came, started throwing rocks and dirt over the fence and the berm, the perimeter wall, and eventually within minutes came across and started opening fire. So Derek and Andres, together with the rest of the population, the IDP population, started running away from the armed actors and recognizing through their security training that they were not safe just running. They needed to get down and out of the way. So they took shelter inside of a local, what we call a tukul, which is the South Sudan's traditional home that had been built. And they took shelter inside there and to get out of the way. And inside the shelter, there was 14 women and children. And so there's Derek and Andres and 14 women and children. And all they can hear outside is shooting and screaming and people being killed and hurt. And so there was two entrances to the tukul. So they each sat one in one entrance, one in the other. They described the women and children as basically trying to basically climb underneath them. They were so frightened. And they were trying to keep everybody calm and quiet. And over the course of the attack, on three separate occasions, armed actors entered, put their faces, their bodies, their weapons in through the opening and demanded that Derek and Andres leave. And to leave the women and children, they said, we'll let you go, but you leave. And Derek and Andres refused to do so. They were yelling and making the heightened emotions, as you can imagine, making it very clear that we are humanitarians. We're a nonviolent peace force. These are women and children. They have nothing to do with this fight. We will not leave them. And all three times, the armed attackers went away and did leave them. And so through the course of their courage and their ability and their quick thinking, drawing from their training, they saved the lives of these women and children over the course of a massacre that killed almost 60 people in about 20 minutes. And as you said earlier, as Derek commented, is they knew without a shadow of doubt, had they been armed, it would have done nothing but escalate what had happened. The fact that they were unarmed, they were holding up their NPIDs, and they were just continuing over and over again. They had at one point one of the attackers start to actually rationalize with them, saying, this is not about you, this is not your fight, we will let you go, we will guarantee your safety, enough to have that conversation. And Derek and Andres were able to engage back with them and saying, we could never leave these women and children, we could never do that. And in the over the course of the event, they were able to save their lives.
Wow. This is a very, very powerful story, Tiffany, and it really shows the power of unarmed peacekeeping and the reality of what it can do when it's being used. And You're listening to Peace Paradigm Radio. We're talking with Tiffany Eastholm about her work in South Sudan. Thanks again, Tiffany, for being on Peace Paradigm Radio. Can you tell us a little bit more about what made that situation powerful? You said that because they were unarmed, that's what made it powerful. Your insights have been so revealing about this, about nonviolence and about the work, that I'm just interested in how you felt when you first heard this story.
Well, interestingly, when they first took shelter, they were able to make a call to us. And they weren't entirely sure what was happening at the time, but that there was some fighting, there's some gunfire, and they were taking shelter. And so we were on standby in Zuba, about 100 kilometers away, which takes, in South Sudan, about 6 hours to drive because of the lack of infrastructure. And so we were on standby waiting to find out what had happened.
Gee, I'm sorry. We're also waiting to find out what had happened, and you seem to have cut out momentarily. When we bring you back in, I know there's one question that's on my mind and on everybody's mind when we hear the stories of the power of nonviolent protection, and that is, can this be brought to scale? Where can we go with this? And so I'd like you to talk, when you're finished answering Stephanie's question, talk about the recent declaration in the UN that Mel Duncan has been able to bring about.
Sure. Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can hear you now, thankfully.
Great. Yeah, so, I mean, the intensity of the moment, and I really think it's important to say Because often people have an image of sort of what you mentioned earlier, Michael, about the parachuting into very dangerous situations and being human shields or sort of the cowboys approach. And this, as dangerous as the situation was, it was that's not what it was. Our staff would never intentionally run into a live fire situation. Once that's happening, the only smart thing for everybody to do is take cover. They were already in the situation that was happening around them, and then they used their courage and their training and their intellect to engage in nonviolent practice in a situation where they found themselves in. So I think that's an important point to make. The final person who came into the structure was somebody who was swinging a machete, and so pulled the curtain back and had a machete in full swing right behind the head, ready to bring it down. And the first person they saw was Derek, who is from the UK, sandy blonde hair, very, very white skin, in a place you don't expect to see that. Derek said the person was so shocked to see somebody who was not of that community basically screamed and dropped the weapon. So you have sort of that extreme to the other extreme of the men with guns who were trying to speak to them and explain to them, and they were having this conversation about what the fight was about. So I think it's a good illustration of the range of things that can happen in those heated moments. Andreas and Derek's, ability to remain calm and engaged and really work together as a team to manage the situation has been some of the things that really stood out. I went to Bor a couple of days later to support the team. The initial hours and days right after the attack was about, dealing with medical evacuation of flights of people who were injured. Derek and Andreas were part of, most unfortunately, helping collect the people who were killed in the attack. And then I went a couple of days later, as soon as I could go and spend some time with them and to get a sense of how they were and to find out how they were going. And it was, they were profoundly moved.
As we are.
Yeah. And I think being able to hear them sort of process and articulate their experience, and to be able to really, I was so impressed with their ability to put it into the framework of nonviolence. And these are, younger men, one could say, if you saw them on the street, you'd say, oh, these macho men. And they were so intellectual and sensitive about their experience. This was not we were the heroes of the moment. This was not about being macho. This was about touching on the thing that the both of them are both very deeply committed to, which is nonviolence, and having been able to put it to the test in the most extreme circumstance.
Yeah, the system was put to a test, and it worked. It's extremely encouraging. I want to highlight, Tiffany, one thing that you mentioned about the unexpectedness that the would-be attacker with the machete encountered. Mm-hmm. This is a fairly common dynamic in all nonviolent confrontations, because when you get into attack mode, your world shrinks down to a very narrow spectrum of expectations. It's fight or flight. And then when you see somebody who's not in that worldview and they're standing calmly smiling at you, telling you, no, there's another world, there's a shock value there that you can often exploit to, as you were saying before, open up a conversation and make people into human beings.
Mm-hmm.
So let's get to my question, which I think is on everybody's mind.
Who we're talking to?
Yes, we are talking with Tiffany Eastome. Thank you, Stephanie. You're keeping me honest. Tiffany Eastome of Nonviolent Peace Force, recently returned from being country director in South Sudan, one of the most dangerous conflicts in the world. And I wanted to ask you about signs of growth, signs of acceptance, because these stories are so powerful. They're so beautiful. We want them to become the texture of the new world. So maybe you could talk about the recent mention in this UN report and other ways that you have seen that you were telling me about the other day, that that you and Mel and some people feel that that a change is coming. There is some recognition of this incredible power that does seem to be building, maybe toward a tipping point. It doesn't seem to be working very well. Let me give my amateurish version of what I think happened, because I'm going to be at that August World Body in a couple of weeks. I'm participating in a panel on the culture of peace and the media. But due to the work of our very good friend Mel Duncan, who has been on this program, we have seen for the first time a mention of unarmed civilian peacekeeping in an important United Nations document. You know, the trouble with UN peacekeeping all along, in my view, has been that it's trying to keep peace by non-peaceful means. That, you know, go in with all these weapons and then don't use them is not at all the same psychology and the same dynamic as the story that we just heard about Derek Oakley and Andres Gutierrez and unarmed peacekeeping in general. So it has taken a while for the UN to acknowledge and recognize the power and the possibility in this kind of peacekeeping. And I think that's a very hopeful development. You know, you know so much from your experience and your training, and you have learned so much in the field that I'm going to ask if we can have you back on this program again when you're in a civilized part of the world like Victoria and can get a good connection, and that we can continue this conversation. Tiffany, I'll have to take
that. We'll have to take that as a yes.
We'll take it as a yes.
Okay. Thank you so much, Tiffany Ustem, for joining us on Peace Paradigm Radio. You know, it's been, you know, the phone was a little bit challenging on this specific call, but the interview was so powerful and so important that even if there were little brief moments of, you know, the phone getting into the right connection, I felt like it was worth it because what came out was very, very important. And but we haven't done any nonviolence in the news. We're almost done with the show. So why don't we go and talk about, you know, we were talking about an institution. We're talking with Tiffany Ustem of the Nonviolent Peace Force about how nonviolence worked in the situation of a very violent conflict and how it's, you know, it's building its way from within to without. And that when we see it happen on a small scale, on a large scale, these are signs not that it only works in those places, but that we can build on it everywhere. Yeah. And yet, you know, nonviolence is happening all over the world in places that aren't just in institutions. It's happening all over. And that's really what the power of having some nonviolence in the news is about. And you take so much time every week, Michael, to prepare such a nice report. It would be a shame not to have it. So why don't you tell us a little bit about what's going on in the news this year, this week?
Thank you, Stephanie. I'll be happy to do that. And I was almost sniveling there when you were acknowledging how much hard work I put into this. Seriously, though, it was a little bit less hard this time around because we do have a volunteer who's helping us and has prepared some of these items for us. So thank you, Zach Healy. You know, one of the things that we do in the Nonviolence in the News is to acknowledge the passing of great nonviolent heroes. So I would like to mention that a very dear friend of mine and of most of the nonviolence world, Reverend George Hauser, who was a conscientious objector in World War II. You can see part of that story in a wonderful documentary film called The Good War and Those Who Refused to Fight It. And then he played a really significant role in founding Congress of Racial Equality back in 1947, if you could believe that. I was 10 years old. He was on a bus with 15 others, 8 white, 8 black people, heading into the South on Greyhound to test the recent legislation that segregation in public transportation was illegal. And you can imagine the violence that they faced. George spent the rest of his life working on racial equality and other nonviolence issues. He was an extraordinarily quiet person who never took credit, never sought glory for any of these things, something which I wish I could learn to emulate. And we were kind of hoping that he would actually make it to age 100. But this Wednesday of this week, he finally did pass on at age 99 and a half, very peacefully, surrounded by his family and friends at Friends House in Santa Rosa.
Which in itself is a very nonviolent thing to do, to see the body that you are a trustee of the body and to hold on to it when you need to hold on to it and to let go of it when it's time to let go as well.
Well said, Stephanie. And that was exactly the impression that I got from George in these visits, that he had an indomitable fighting spirit and he was not going to give up, but at the same time, he wasn't going to cling and he wasn't going to resist the inevitable, and his faith in God pulled him through at the end quite beautifully. I am happy to say that for once, we are not breaking news that is not in the mainstream media, because even the New York Times has covered with a very, very good obituary the passing of George Hauser. So I've already mentioned that in a couple of weeks' time, I will be at the United Nations on a panel on the culture of peace and will report back to you on how that goes. But I can report to you that last weekend, I was at the first annual meeting of the Campaign Nonviolence, which took place in Santa Fe, New Mexico. We had some wonderful speakers. Campaign Nonviolence works by coordinating activities by local communities all over the country, and they had really quite a remarkable success in their first year. They had over 250 events, I think, in all 50 states. Once again, all 50 states have signed up with events that they're going to participate in around the International Day of Peace, which is September 21. So the conference had some wonderful speakers. Outstanding in my mind was Erica Chenoweth, the co-author of Why Civil Resistance Works. And as John Deere pointed out in introducing and concluding Erica's heartwarming and thrilling presentation, some of which I will very briefly summarize for you in a minute, he said, "This is the first time that a social scientist has done a scientific study, a comparative study of violent and nonviolent movements. And the results are absolutely astounding." I don't think there were many dry eyes in the house when Erica was finished with her presentation. So some of those highlights. Erica Chenoweth and Maria Stefan studied hundreds, I think close to 300 episodes of insurrection. So we're talking only about one type of nonviolent action, which is a freedom struggle or a liberation struggle. There are many, many infinite varieties of ways that nonviolence can be applied, but these were scientists studying this particular situation, which is often regarded as one of the most drastic. And they found that if the insurrection was nonviolent, and let me hastily add that we are talking only about the most, choosing my words carefully here, the most rudimentary kind of nonviolence. And for example, one protester in Yemen said they will not be able to defeat us because we've left our guns at home. So even the most rudimentary, the most fundamental form of nonviolence, these uprisings were successful 56% of the time. The violent ones, well, they were successful 23% of the time. So let's do the math. The nonviolence was twice as effective, even at this preliminary stage. Mm. Now, that I suspected that, but one thing that really blew me away, I didn't know this was going to be found at all, because people always say that, yes, nonviolence takes so much time, and look how much time it took Gandhi to get India liberated. Well, what they found was, on average, a nonviolent insurrection was successful in 3 years, whereas on average, a violent one was successful in 9 years, one-third the time. Much, much less cost in blood and treasure. And here was the really astounding finding that I think I mentioned on this program before. Nonviolent insurrections led to greater democratic freedoms, even if they failed, quote-unquote, than violent ones led to even when they, quote-unquote, succeeded. And we, in the nonviolence world, have always known the explanation for that, that right means alone can bring about right ends. And when you use violence, you're going to have a violent result, which shows up in many different ways, not just in people getting shot and water cannoned on the street. And this leads me to one of the events that I wanted to mention. To locate it here, the in Central America, a number of communities have been opposing land grabs. We're talking about things, musicians and others going across Guatemala, Nicaragua, Venezuela, and the United States since 2007. And communities across Guatemala have held over 75 community-wide consultations on projects like mining and hydroelectric dams. In every consultation, communities have overwhelmingly rejected any extractive projects on their land and said that they can thank you very much, but we can do this ourselves. Now, focusing back on the U.S. in particular, there is a new group, and I get this news from Waging Nonviolence, a new group which is modeled partly on an episode called Take Back the Bronx and is teamed up with Cop Watch. This new group is called Disarm NYPD, New York Police Department, and they're aiming at some pretty drastic changes, stripping police of their weapons. They want to actually push the police out of their neighborhoods entirely. And then within these spaces that have been cleared up, the group wants to help residents form conflict resolution bodies to make police obsolete and to build councils and networks to enable local communities to organize their own lives. Mm-hmm. So if you've had my course, or if you read America Without Violence, or any of my newer books.
Or if you've even looked at the news with the level of awareness of police violence rising.
Exactly.
Our awareness is rising, not necessarily the violence, right?
Yeah, well, both. Yeah. And so if you have been able to look at this with any sophistication, you will resonate, as I did, with this last remark that they want to clear the police out and then learn how to do it themselves. That if you're a B-plus student, let me regress to my professorial identity here. If you're a B-plus student, you will say, that is exactly what Gandhi called for. That's constructive program. But if you're an A student, you would say that there's one slight difference. Gandhi's insisted you had to do that first. He told his followers that if they thought that they could get rid of the British and then fix India's society, they were dreaming. That you had to fix India's society first, and then on that infrastructure, with that platform, then say to the British, we don't need you anymore. So this is a pretty darn good breakthrough, almost enough to satisfy me. Mm-hmm. But let's be following that group. Still in the U.S., to talk about, to seg over to climate issues, a man in Middletown, Connecticut, Vic Lancia, to celebrate his 75th birthday, mm-hmm. putting him almost up there in my category, he locked himself onto two giant concrete-filled barrels decorated with candles and frosting that he called birthday cakes. And these were stationed on a road leading up to a site where a corporation called Spectra Energy has been doing things that have involved regularly using the facility to expand fracking infrastructure. So they set up this birthday protest. You can read about it at capitalismversusclimate.org. That's capitalismvsclimate.org. And they maintained that blockade for 2 hours, whereupon Vic negotiated with the police and unlocked himself. He was not arrested. But so that was a happy conclusion to a very, very happy birthday party, which I think Vic will remember mm-hmm. for at least 25 more years. Meanwhile, the whole issue of climate action is coming to, I believe, and others believe with me, is coming to some kind of climax. Annie Leonard, whom you are familiar with from the story of Stuff, is now the director of Greenpeace USA and says there is no choice. We have already tried a gentler strategy, and that didn't work. So again, let's weigh in here with the theoretical angle. This is exactly how you do it. You don't start with drastic protest. You don't start with in-your-face anger. You start lower down on the what we call the escalation curve to try petitioning and reasoning with your opponent, even though you think there's basically no chance that they'll respond. It still puts you in a better position and creates a better image of who you are to do that due diligence first. So for years, they've been writing letters, gathering names on petitions and waving a few signs. But since there has not been a significant enough response, there's been some, but not enough. We're creeping up to that 2 degrees of global temperature rising, which many global climate scientists think may be irreversible. They now are escalating to more protesting and blockading tactics. And since they're doing the right thing, I can only assume that if they carry through, they will be successful. Mm-hmm. Wanted to quote, although devoutly nonviolent and officially independent from one another, protesters from both Greenpeace and this new organization, Rising Tide, said they expect the months ahead to be defined by much more than bullhorns and bandanas. Their goal is to stop the money and machinery of the fossil fuel industry with their own bodies. Remarkably enough, religious communities have been weighing in quite beautifully on this overall issue. We know about the Pope's statement that we must be stewards and must resist climate change. But now the Islamic community has become the latest religious community to reaffirm a duty of stewardship. Back last Tuesday, prominent Muslims from 20 countries urged all followers of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, that's 1.6 billion people, to, quote, set in motion a new model of well-being. Yeah. They signed an 8-page declaration in Istanbul, which included the Grand Muftis of Lebanon and Uganda, and they issued an urgent message to madrasas and mosques worldwide to avoid, quote, ending life as we know it. They called for a rapid phase-out of fossil fuels. Now, ponder this for a minute. This is not going to go down very well with Saudi Arabia. This is a community in the world whose prosperity has been based on the extraction of fossil fuels. And now they are calling for leaving that oil in the ground. That's, quote, their oil, that's Allah's bounty, and they're calling for leaving it on the ground. I think that's extremely impressive. So let me cycle back to the U.S. for one quick item. We have to come to a conclusion here. But again, on the do-it-yourself constructive program kind of area, in Cincinnati, and I remember Ohio is the state that sent Dennis Kucinich to Congress, a group called One Worker, One Vote has been pursuing a grassroots agenda to implement a union co-op model, which calls for business structures that combines workers and sometimes community ownership with union representation. They have set up a number of economies, alternative economies and organizations in the city of Cincinnati. That's going to be the place to work for the new economic agenda. Thank you for listening to Peace Paradigm Radio. And in case Stephanie doesn't remember to say this, take care of one another and then for the next 2 weeks.
Thanks, everybody, again for joining us on Peace Paradigm Radio. Thanks to KWMR, our mother station here in Point Reyes Station. Thank you to all of our staff and volunteers of the Meta Center to make this possible. And if you want an archive of the show and listen to it later, at www.metacenter.org. That's Meta with 2 T's. And until the next time, everybody, I will say it. Take care of one another. Bye-bye.